In the coming week, extreme springtime weather events ramp up. Myanmar's military junta marks Armed Forces Day, and leaders from Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Uruguay convene for a virtual trade summit. It's March 25th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, we just marked the official first day of spring, which for close climate watchers signals the beginning of a shift in upcoming extreme weather events. Days of torrential rain throughout eastern Australia have spawned massive flooding throughout the region, forcing the evacuation of some 40,000 people. And throughout the United States, long-range forecasters are predicting severe tornadoes and droughts in this spring's future. Indeed, just before we sat down to record this podcast, notes went out that tornadoes are expected this day in much of the South. Bob, can you tell us a bit about why springtime is such a prominent time of the year for climate change-induced extreme weather events to occur?
Sure, Jim. Without trying to sound too much like obvious Chauncey Gardner in being there, for example, I'll just mention that according to places like the Weather Channel, you know, spring is when you have this period, what they call a battleground time of year between warm and cold weather forces. You have warmer air trying to move northward and the last of the winter's cold air plunging out of Canada. This is in the context of North America, especially in the United States. And so these sort of contrasting temperatures then fuel very variable weather conditions. And they've been much more variable and much more intense in recent years. The tornadoes you mentioned, Jim, are supposedly going to be getting them in the course of the day today. This is Thursday. We had just a little bit more than a week ago, there were 50 tornadoes that rampaged through the southern U.S. states of Mississippi and Alabama. The National Weather Service is declaring the level 5 out of 5 high risk for severe weather, especially today. And then you have a whole bunch of other things starting to play out as well, Jim. You have a La Nina weather system. Sometimes you hear El Nino or La Nina. La Nina tends to draw moisture from humid, steamy conditions north out of the Gulf into these benighted southern states along the Gulf Coast, again, Mississippi and Alabama in particular. And so that's contributing to these intense bouts of tornadoes and so forth. Again, the intense weather varies across the country. You have the West and Southwest in particular, looking at a prolonged drought. The organization known as the U.S. Drought Monitor reports that almost 40% of the Western U.S. is in extreme or exceptional drought. And that's something that none of the Western states were experiencing a year ago. So this is something to deal with. And then you have the other side of the world, Australia, which is not in springtime. It's coming out of its summer into fall. They've been dealing with once in a century floods. And these are only 18 or months or so after once in a century fires. So Australia is sort of on the cutting edge as well on extreme weather events. And it's stirring debate there over what's to be done in terms of everything from, you know, carbon mitigation to resilience issues. And it certainly is the case in this country now where you have the new Biden administration planning to tee up a whole host of things.
Well, that raises an interesting question, Bob. Do you see the Biden administration trying to take these extreme weather events as evidence for the need to get Congress to act to make the kind of fundamental structural changes in the economy and our infrastructure to reduce the emissions of heat trapping gases? And I ask that against the backdrop of not too long ago, Texas was freezing, and the argument you heard from many Republicans, certainly from many state Republican office holders in Texas, was it was the reliance on green energy, wind turbines that froze that caused all of the problems in Texas.
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's going to be at the heart of what's going to surely be a raging debate on this. I mean, first of all, the last instance you pointed to was also mentioned as a kind of a blown out of proportion accusation against renewables, when in fact there were problems with the existing old-fashioned energy grid that were mostly to blame for Texas's woes.
I should also note that wind turbines in places like Iowa, in Minnesota, and Antarctica functioned perfectly fine in weather that was far colder than Texas experienced in its cold snap.
Yeah, and it gets to the question of the resilience for whatever choices you make as a country. And again, this country, despite these debates, the United States is moving steadily and fairly swiftly towards more and more renewables, wind and solar in particular. And so you have the Biden administration with a chance to sort of seize the narrative while it's in office, while it has kind of the bully pulpit, so to speak, and while it is trying to now harness some new legislation. There are reports coming out about a massive infrastructure bill that the administration may be pushing, which includes all sorts of plans for changes to the energy grid toward a more green energy grid, for example. There's going to be a summit President Biden is supposed to convene around Earth Day next month in which he will convene other like-minded countries to make all sorts of declarations about the, first of all, the importance and the growing concern about extreme weather, about climate change, about carbon emissions, and maybe, you know, galvanize some international actions about it. It's something that continues to beset the world. It's something that you're hearing more and more concern about. You're still not seeing the critical mass of action that is meaningfully limiting carbon emissions globally. But these changes in energy in particular are something to watch, I think, Jim. And it's something that the administration can make some moves on. It's still going to require support from Republicans, I think, to go further. But I do think it's the administration's time now with spring. We'll have to see how it sort of takes note of the drought, of the tornadoes, of other extreme incidents, and uses those to sort of, you know, add to a narrative about what the U.S. can do to improve its ability to respond to these, but also to head off, you know, a longer cascade of such actions because of carbon emissions.
I suspect, Bob, you're right that it's going to be worthwhile to pay attention to this infrastructure bill that we think the Biden administration is going to put forth. This will go through a process of reconciliation. And I suspect that the way the Biden team talks about it is going to depend upon the audience. For some people, they'll be framing it in terms of what it does for climate change. I think for a lot of other audiences, are going to be talking about what it means for jobs. Still other audiences are going to be what it means for our ability to compete with China. Obviously, Americans have been talking about infrastructure and its deficiencies for quite a long time, and we haven't made that step to go forward. The question obviously is going to be one of how do you pay for it, which means you're going to be talking about raising taxes. And that, of course, is going to lead its critics in the Republican Party to talk about how America can't afford at this moment to pay higher taxes. So there's going to be a lot of different messaging going on.
Yeah, that's true. And I think you'll have another opportunity for the administration to possibly note or take part in a global sort of environmental event, which is known as Earth Hour. That's going to be happening this weekend around the world, where depending on what country you're in, there's all sorts of campaigns to sort of turn off the lights for an hour to reflect on what's happening to the world, to reflect on what sort of actions can make a difference and so forth. I do think the administration sees polling information that indicates concern in these areas in the U.S. to support some sort of momentum in this direction.
Well, let's see if they can overcome the obvious political obstacles to actually getting something done.
Well, Jim, let's turn our attention to Myanmar, where the country's junta continues its violent crackdown on pro-democracy protesters. Now, we've talked about this before in the podcast. It's still playing out. The junta is dug in. But with this as the backdrop, what can you tell us about the significance of the March 27th Armed Forces Day in Myanmar?
March 27th is a big day in Myanmar because it marks the military's resistance to the 1945 Japanese occupation. And of course, as you point out, this year, the celebration of the anniversary is going to take place against the backdrop of the resistance by many Burmese to the military's February 1 coup. We've talked about this before. Many Burmese have already taken to the street. Protesters participated in a silent strike against the government earlier this week. Businesses and shops in some cities were closed. People stayed home. The protests initially were peaceful. No violence broke out. That has changed in recent weeks. I think we're now nearly 300 Burmese have been killed by government forces. The military has arrested more than 2,000 people. And I think many people are worrying that the ceremonies honoring Armed Forces Day could turn violent and that the junta's response could be quite ugly. Now, I should note that the junta has been trying to divide the opposition and has been trying to woo a number of armed ethnic groups, inviting them to participate in ceremonies. Most of those invitations, as I understand it, have been turned down by the groups. And I'll note that earlier this week, the Arakan Army, which is an important ethnic militia group in Myanmar's Rakhine State, joined other ethnic groups in condemning the junta in its violent crackdown. Now, I guess we sort of maybe take a step back and make the point that Myanmar, which is a country of about 58 million people, has some 135 different ethnic groups. Many of them are quite small numerically, as Burmese are about 68-69% of the population overall. But tensions between the dominant Burmese group and many other ethnic groups have been quite deep and quite long running. I think one of the concerns many people have looking at it is whether we're going to be seeing anti-coup protesters starting to form their own military opposition groups, and will they be joining link with existing ethnic insurgencies? And so Myanmar's in a very difficult spot, and it's not clear that existing outside pressure from the United States and other countries has done much of anything to change the military's commitment commitment to keep itself in power.
Yeah, I was going to note on that last point, Jim, has there been any indication that this time around, because this is a country that has had decades of military elite, you know, sort of running the show and, you know, facing various waves of outside pressure, but has there any indication that this time around, given some of the signals we've gotten, even from some countries in ASEAN, like Indonesia, for example, but also maybe from some regional powers like India or even Japan, is there any sense that this leadership clique has any vulnerability to outside pressure or from China for that matter? Because there was some concern even registered by China recently.
So far, Bob, we haven't seen any signs of splits within the ruling military junta. No doubt when the military launched the junta, they understood the likely reaction by other countries and were prepared to deal with the sanctions in the international condemnation. Quite clearly, with the ratcheting up of violence and the much tougher crackdown in protesters, the military junta is willing to run the risk of even greater external pressure.
But by the same token, we're also looking at an opposition that might be of a different nature and a different resiliency than maybe in the past, Jim. You've had everything from healthcare workers to students to others who are showing quite a bit of bravery and sort of defying the military clique. And yet they're also paying for it. But it does seem like they're also taking advantage of whatever social and other media are available to get the word out, because we are still finding out what's going on in Myanmar, much more so than we have in some other countries.
Certainly have, Bob. And it's been quite impressive. The number of Burmese who've turned out in the street, even in the face of the government's willingness to crack down, to demand a return to democracy. But again, you know, Myanmar, Burma has a very complicated history, and its democratic opening several years ago was proclaimed and noticed precisely because the country had for so long existed in this sort of very isolated way, cut off from much of the rest of the world. And now opening up again, it's a fairly sizable country. There was great hope for a flowering of the Burmese economy and what that would lead, but the military clearly has taken things in a backward direction. Again, all signals are they're willing to pay the price to sort of impose the order that they want. Of course, it's one thing to make that commitment if you are a ruling junta. The question is, can you obviously carry it out? Again, Myanmar is a country with multiple divisions, and it's going to be worthwhile to sort of pay attention to what happens. Again, events can play a very big role here. What happens, for example, this weekend as Armed Forces Day is marked? Is there something that happens that even further galvanizes the opposition or divides it? I mean, events matter in these instances.
And so we'll look at Armed Forces Day as perhaps not a day of any sort of national unity, Jim, but rather of potential further fissures and even violence.
I think that's a fair way to describe it, Bob. But let's switch gears and turn our attention to Latin America. In the coming week, leaders from the Mercosur trade bloc, that's Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Uruguay, are set to convene virtually for a summit. This summit, which is to be held tomorrow, was originally scheduled to be a face-to-face presidential summit in Argentina. That's because Argentina currently holds the rotating chair of the trade bloc. So can you give us a little bit of context for us, Bob? Maybe to start with, what is Mercosur?
Sure, Jim. And I should also note, this is not just any summit. It's a 30th anniversary summit. It's 30 years since the 1991 Treaty of Asunción, which formed Mercosur with the four founding countries, Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Uruguay. I also should note that Venezuela has had membership, but that has been suspended under a step taken by the founding members concerning undemocratic behavior by a member. Paraguay was briefly suspended as well under those same circumstances. And there is a country that's sort of a member in waiting, which is Bolivia, but it's been waiting for almost a decade and still requiring accession due to some opposition from Brazil. So it's not clear when Bolivia might join. I should also add there are associate members, which includes Bolivia, Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, Guyana, Peru, and Suriname. So a good chunk of South America is involved in Mercosur. The four core members basically formed a customs union. They did a great deal to reduce tariffs and to boost trade, especially the first decade of Mercosur agreement. It should be noted that the two titans in this are Brazil and Argentina, two much bigger economies, biggest economies in the area. And they were sort of the driving force behind this originally. And they have also been behind a now nearly 20-year effort to try to strike a deal with the European Union, which would be one of, if not the largest trade pact in the world. That has been foundering of late because of the concern among some European Union countries about Brazil's environmental policies. And it's not clear when those concerns are going to be cleared up right now. So we have taken taking place tomorrow, this virtual summit of Argentina's Alberto Fernandez, Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro, Paraguay's Mario Abdo Benitez, and Uruguay's Luis Lacalle Pou. They have a lot on their plate, obviously. I should add, they're meeting virtually, like so many other summits and conferences, because of the ongoing pandemic, which has hit the continent hard, especially in Brazil and in Paraguay. Brazil is now experiencing something like 3,000 or more deaths a day. I believe it's the worst daily fatality rate in the world at the moment. This is a level that the U.S. hit earlier this year, but has receded from sharply. It's a crisis in some of the states of Brazil. It's been a big problem for Paraguay as well, which is seeking desperately to find a path towards vaccines. There were reports, incidentally, that Paraguay, there were overtures from China to Paraguay that it could provide vaccines if Paraguay saw to it to no longer have diplomatic relations with Taiwan. And that seems to have been rebuffed. But Paraguay, I think, along with Brazil, Uruguay, and Argentina, are going to be talking quite a bit about COVID diplomacy and vaccine diplomacy in this meeting, as well as the future of potentially of an EU trade deal.
Bob, just to go back to sort of the founding of Mercosur, I just want to do a plug for the work your team at CFR has done. There is a CFR backgrounder available at CFR.org about Mercosur, its history, how it came about, and the rest. And for people who are interested in these issues, I would flag it for them. It's a really good primer on the organization. I'm sort of just curious, though, as my understanding of Mercosur, it was designed to provide economic integration in Latin America. And again, there's partly the example of the EU, and you sort of look at the EU. For whatever shortcomings it may have, it was very good at promoting economic integration and growth, at least for quite a while. Mercosur hasn't seemed to have worked, at least the way the press release described it when it was first hatched. There hasn't been the same kind of economic integration in Latin America as you see elsewhere. Just again, think of the EU. Why has that been the case?
As you dig into the political situations in each of those countries, it becomes a bit more understandable. At the moment, I just cited the case of Brazil, which is going through a particular moment of upheaval, shall we say, domestically, according to many reports, in terms of divisions between people right of center and supporters of populist conservative President Bolsonaro and the socialist wing, the very strong left wing of, traditionally of Brazil, epitomized by Lula, who's now making a comeback, seemingly, and could be in the picture for a future presidential run. And you have, you know, Argentina, the other big partner here, has Alberto Fernandez. He's coming at things from a more left of center approach. He also has his trade skepticism, as well as his pro-trade aspects in his government. If you look at the Argentinian political landscape, but also Paraguay and Uruguay, for that matter, all of them have had some political upheaval since Mercosur went into effect that would, you know, sort of mitigate against smooth sailing of some sort of major trade initiative like Mercosur is. I think Venezuela is politically probably in the worst shape of any country on the continent right now. And Bolivia is going through a roiling turnover. You have, outside of Chile, really, a lot of countries that are dealing with a great many political crises or sort of ebbs and flows of political crises. And it's not the kind of thing that creates any sort of momentum. So it's a combination of things, Jim, but I guess I would come back to is sort of the lack of kind of a strong domestic backbone that would really support this kind of a free trade agreement.
My takeaway, Bob, from the long list of problems you laid out is that we're not likely to see any major breakthroughs at this meeting tomorrow that is going to make us change our basic understanding of what Mercosur is and what it is capable of doing.
There have been indications going into the meeting, Jim, of these countries trying to help each other. I think Argentina has made several thousand doses of the vaccine, for example, available to Paraguay. I think there is a shared concern about the ongoing high levels of infection on the continent, and that, you know, the vaccination and so-called herd immunity is something that has to be accomplished regionally. So I do think you'll see, at least rhetorically and possibly practically, some steps taken in that front. I think otherwise you're right.
I will wait to see what actually emerges from the meeting.
Jim, we've talked our way into the audience figure of the week portion of the podcast. This is where listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, the audience selected the figure hundreds, as in hundreds of Rohingya missing. Jim, what's the significance of this?
What the audience is flagging for is, Bob, is a massive fire that broke out at a refugee camp in Cox's Bazar in southern Bangladesh. That fire has left at least a dozen dead, hundreds more missing, in upward of 50 50,000 people without shelter of any kind. Now, the Rohingya in the camp are refugees who fled neighboring Myanmar, and they have lived in squalor in these improvised refugee camps. And obviously, the fire has made that humanitarian situation just worse. There is a saving grace in the story, if we can put it that way. The fire began in the middle of the day rather than at night. I think the assessment is that if the fire had in fact taken place in the middle of the night, the death toll would have been far higher. We're still not sure what the source of the fire is. And there's some speculation that recent innovations like putting barbed wire around the camp may have actually made things worse because it impeded the ability of people to flee. What is clear is that the Rohingya are being left to pick up the pieces in what is a difficult situation. Again, the fire destroyed not just people's living accommodations, but health clinics, mosques, community centers, and the like. And of course, the prospects are pretty dismal that the Rohingya are going to be allowed to return to Myanmar. That was the case before the coup on February 1st, and if anything, it's even less likely under the rule of the military government. The reality is that the Burmese government, whether civilian or military, isn't inclined to accept the Rohingya, and many of the Rohingya fear what will happen to them even if they are allowed to return to Myanmar.
It's another reminder, when you list some of those numbers, Jim, just like 50,000 people, you know, rendered homeless, just starts to give a sense of the scale of the numbers of Rohingya. I believe it's many hundreds of thousands that are still in Bangladesh, including in Cox's Bazar alone. I think it just points out again that of the many places that are disproportionately affected during this time of crisis in the world, the refugees have to have it among the worst. The fire reminded me of the one that took place on one of the Greek islands of refugees trying to get to Europe. That one, I believe, was set actually by people trying to basically ward them off and send them back to their countries of origin. As you said, we don't know yet about this one in Bangladesh. It could have been accidental one, but still, I think, brings to light their fate. We were just talking about vaccines. Refugee camps have been referenced again and again as one of the more vulnerable places for a spread of a pandemic. And as a vaccine priority, they're not near the top of the list.
Overall, it is just a horrific situation that the Rohingya Muslims face in the refugee camps, and also Rohingya who still live in Myanmar, who worry greatly about becoming the target of ethnic violence. And it's a situation in which the international community, if I can use that phrase, has issued a number of soaring declarations about the need to act, but has been unable to compel a resolution to the situation. And again, people live in Cox's Bazar and other refugee camps, and it's not just Rohingya, in what are just awful situations.
You know, I should note our colleague Josh Kurlansik wrote a recent blog post about, you know, Myanmar's ongoing crisis and crackdown, creating a new wave of refugees from Myanmar, far beyond Rohingya, to members of the political opposition and just protesters and so forth. And basically saying, you know, it's incumbent on countries in the region to make place and to plan for what could be people numbering in the thousands fleeing Myanmar. So it's not only the existing amount of people who are potentially victims of crimes against humanity, the Rohingyas, but also a new wave from Myanmar.
And of course, the challenge there is that many of the countries that are receiving more refugees, A, don't want them, and you get the backlash against, from their point of view, outsiders coming into their communities. But you're also talking, in many cases, particularly in the case of Bangladesh, of countries that themselves have limited resources and limited capability to be able to absorb new populations. And overall, the international effort to aid refugees, whether you're talking about Rohingya in Cox's Bazar, or you're talking about Syrian refugees in a variety of places around the country of Syria or elsewhere, has been limited. The challenge of refugees and also internally displaced people has only grown over the last decade, but I don't think the resources that we devote to it have kept pace. And so you have people who are just living in wretched conditions with very little prospect that they're going to be able to return home. And this is a problem that is going to persist.
And I thank our audience Twitter followers for raising our attention to that issue. And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The Holi Festival of Colors takes place in India, and Vietnam takes over the presidency of the UN Security Council.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as a recording engineer. Thank you very much, Zoe. Special thanks also go out to Anna Shortridge and Bethany Wright for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.